Okay, now I'm on. Okay, hope everybody had a wonderful Easter. And you're ready to finish up our study of Hebrews. Thank you. Okay. Well, I know a lot of you in this Bible study are members of our church family here at Grace. And so those of you, like me, have been listening to Dave Gundlach teach on the book of Romans the past couple of months. And sort of a couple weeks before Easter, he actually was talking a lot about Abraham and his faith. He even titled his message, Righteousness by Faith. And it's sort of a sad commentary on me, but one morning I was listening to him talk about Abraham and his faith, and I started to get a little annoyed. I'm like, Dave, that's my material. Because, of course, that's how I had come to think of it by then. And he's going on and on about Abraham, and I'm like, and he even had the temerity to quote the first verse in Hebrews 11. I'm thinking, you're stealing my thunder. Come on, pal. So all that to say, if anything sounds a little repetitive or you feel like you've heard it before, I'm saying that's all Dave's fault, not mine. So let's jump into Hebrews 11. And I mean, truthfully, obviously the topic of faith is so important that it's not going to hurt anybody to hear the same thing, maybe from a slightly different point of view. All right, so the central point of the entire book of Hebrews that we've been studying so far is that Jesus is superior to everything else. He's better. Or as Christina put it when she was teaching on the last chapter, Jesus is the real deal. And we know as Christians that our salvation comes only through faith in Jesus and what he did for us on the cross. And that, of course, is what we celebrated at Easter, is his resurrection and his triumph over sin and death. Now, we also know now that the intended audience of the book of Hebrews was Jewish. And that since the time of Moses, the Jewish people have been trying to earn their salvation by following all the laws that they had been given in the Old Covenant. But we're now living under the New Covenant, and as we learned a couple lessons back, the New Covenant replaced the imperfect Old Covenant. It didn't work because no one could earn their salvation by perfectly following all the laws in the covenant or by good works. Everyone has always fallen short, because we're all broken, imperfect human beings. So again, we know that it's only through faith in Jesus that we can be saved. And what this chapter in Hebrews makes clear is that even before Jesus, from the beginning of time, all the way back to the story of Cain and Abel, that faith has been the only thing that God wanted from his people. In Old Testament times, people needed to have faith in God's promises for the future. In New Testament times, people are saved by faith in Jesus because he's the fulfillment of all of God's promises. And we read a couple weeks ago in Hebrews 9:15 that Jesus' death even retroactively saved all those people who had lived in Old Testament times under the Old Covenant but had had faith in God. And when I checked this point with Dave, he confirmed that that interpretation was correct, but he said that a better way of saying it might be that the reason that God forgave Old Testament saints was because that God knew that in the future, his son would pay the penalty for their sins. And so he was free to forgive them and still be a God of righteousness and justice. So at the end of the day, it seems that no matter when you lived, all people are saved by the same thing, faith. It's always been all about faith, hence my title slide here. Now the writer points out in verse 3 that his Jewish audience already had faith in God. They believed in his existence, and they believed that he created the universe, and they accepted those truths by faith and not by sight because they had never seen God and they hadn't witnessed creation. And I think the writer made this point to get his Jewish audience to understand that they had to take the faith that they already had in God and put it in the new covenant, which God has made through his son, Jesus. And we know that throughout the book of Hebrews, the writer has been encouraging these new converts to hang on to their faith, even when they were suffering persecution for their new Christian beliefs. Because through their faith in Jesus, they could finally have complete forgiveness for their sins and a personal relationship with God. And that's something that Judaism never provided. So I'm going to put up in the PowerPoint now the opening verse of Hebrews 11. Whoops. Okay, which is a wonderful definition of what Christian faith is. And this is from an NIV translation. So faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. One of the commentaries that I read had what I thought was a really good restatement of what this verse, which describes faith, what this verse actually looks like when it's lived out. And in the rest of chapter 11, which is often referred to as the Hall of Faith, we're going to see what faith actually looked like in the lives of the Old Testament people who are mentioned here. So here's the restatement. Faith is confidence that results in action carried out in a variety of situations by ordinary people in response to the unseen God and his promises, with various earthly outcomes, but always the ultimate outcome of God's commendation and reward. So I'm going to leave this restatement up because this is what we're going to see fleshed out as I talk about the rest of chapter 11 of Hebrews. In this chapter, the author takes us through a sweeping review of some of God's people in Old Testament times, giving us many wonderful examples of people with faith, from Abel all the way through King David. And the ultimate purpose behind telling us about these patriarchs and prophets and judges and ordinary people is to convey really a very simple message, that the life of faith has always been the only life that pleases God. Now, as I already mentioned, in Old Testament times, that would have meant faith in God's promises for the future. After the incarnation, it means faith in Jesus as the only way to salvation, because all of God's promises were fulfilled in him. So this central importance of faith is why the phrase, by faith, is used over and over and over when the author writes about the various Old Testament people whom he mentions in this chapter. In verse 4, we read that it was by faith that Abel worshipped and offered a better sacrifice. We're told in verse 5 that it was by faith that Enoch walked with God and was taken from this life. And then in verse 7, we read that it was by faith that Noah obeyed and built an ark. And then there's Abraham, the father of the Jewish nation. And he's actually shown in this chapter of Hebrews to be the perfect example of living a life of faith. Now, one commentary that I read said that rabbis had long taught that Abraham pleased God because of his works, that God looked around the world and finally found in Abraham a man who was outstandingly righteous. And the Jews believed that Abraham was chosen to be the father of God's people because he was inherently such a good and righteous man. So for a Jewish audience to accept the fact, the truth, that salvation is only by faith, it would have to be proved to them that this truth applied to Abraham too. They had to be shown that God was pleased with Abraham not because of any of his works, and not because he was inherently righteous, but only because Abraham trusted and believed in God, which is another way of saying he had faith in God. And in this chapter, the author once again uses the same classic method of teaching that rabbis often used, which was going back to the Old Testament, which the Jews recognized as divinely inspired. So if something was stated as true in the Old Testament, they could know that it came from God. In this point, the author uses the Old Testament to prove the point that Abraham wasn't inherently righteous. He wasn't a righteous man by himself. He was counted righteous by God because of his faith in God's promises. In the story in Genesis 15:6, after God has told Abraham that he'll have more descendants than all the stars that he can see in the evening sky, we read that Abraham believed in the Lord, and God reckoned his belief to him as righteousness. Now, when Dave was teaching on this verse, he actually mentioned that this was the first time that the word believe shows up in scriptures when talking about Abraham believing God. So from this Old Testament verse, it's pretty clear that the source of Abraham's righteousness was his faith in God's promises. After all, Abraham was a pagan man. He had grown up in Ur, which is somewhere in Mesopotamia. And although we're not given the details, somehow God made himself known to Abraham. And from that time forward, Abraham had faith in God, and he trusted in his promises. He trusted in his promises of land, of multiple descendants, and that he would be a blessing to many people. And Abraham lived a life of faith, even though he didn't live to see the fulfillment of any of those promises. Although Abraham reached the promised land, he spent his entire life there moving around as a transient. That's what the phrase in verse 9, living as an alien, refers to. Abraham never actually settled down and took possession of the promised land. And as a result, when he died, the only inheritance he passed on were God's promises. And neither Isaac, Abraham's son, nor Jacob, his grandson, they never took possession of the promised land either. It wasn't actually until 500 years after Jacob's death that Israel finally began to possess the land of Canaan. Now, God also promised Abraham descendants who would come from the son whom he miraculously received when he was 100 years old. And of course, we all know the story of how Abraham later proved the depth of his faith in God when he was willing to sacrifice this precious son. That took tremendous, monumental faith in God's promises of descendants through Isaac. And that faith is why Abraham was counted as righteous. And that faith was the source of his salvation. So the author of Hebrews again used the Old Testament to prove that the concept of salvation by faith did not originate in the New Testament. He used Old Testament scripture to prove that faith has always been what God wanted from his people, including from Abraham, the father of the Jewish nation. That would have been a very, very compelling argument to the Jewish audience that the book of Hebrews was written to. And then we come to Moses, who is especially venerated by many first century Jews as being particularly close to God. And of course, he's the leader and the prophet who brought the old covenant based on laws to the Jews. And ever since then, the Jewish people have been trying to earn their salvation by keeping all the laws they had been given. So what does the writer of Hebrews tell us about Moses? Well, he tells us in verse 25 that it was by faith that Moses chose to be identified with God's people and be mistreated in Egypt. Then we read in verse 27 that it was by faith that Moses left Egypt. And finally, the author tells us in verse 28 that it was by faith that Moses kept the Passover. Now, in each of these examples, Moses had faith in God and he acted on his faith. And each of those three events happened before the old covenant of the law even existed. Moses wasn't given the Ten Commandments and the rest of the law to pass on to the Jewish people until months later on Mount Sinai. So here again, we see that the writer of Hebrews uses the Old Testament scriptures to prove that even Moses, the bringer of the law, even Moses lived by faith. That would have been another very powerful argument to prove to the Jewish audience that the book of Hebrews was written to, that the way to God has always been through faith. And now that Jesus has come, the only way is through faith in him. So clearly, the central importance of faith was critical for the Jewish audience of the book of Hebrews to understand. And it's just as important for us to understand as we live our lives. We too need to be clear on the fact that living a life of faith in Jesus is the only way to God. All the works in the world won't please God and they won't allow us to earn our way into heaven. Works are good, but they're a byproduct or an offshoot of living a life of faith. I think the story of Noah is a good example of this. Noah's eternal salvation did not come from the work of building the ark. It came from his faith in God. Now, his faith also led him to obey God and build the ark, and the ark in turn became the means of saving his life on this earth. But Noah's eternal salvation wasn't based on the boat, it was based on his faith. Now, in looking at the various Old Testament people in this chapter who demonstrated great faith in God's promises, there are some things that they all had in common, and they're included in this restatement of the verse on faith. So let's take a look at what we can learn from these people about what faith actually looked like in their lives. Well, first, their faith involved acting confidently in response to God's promises. Their genuine faith was made known by what they did, by their actions. The story in Genesis 4:4 doesn't give us any details about why Abel's offering was pleasing to God and Cain's was not. But somehow, both Cain and Abel knew the kind of offerings that God wanted that would prove their faith in him and their obedience to him. And we're told that it was by faith that Abel acted, offering God a superior sacrifice. It was also by faith that Noah acted. He responded to the divine warning he received, and he took 100 years to build an ark. And when God called Abraham, he acted. He left familiar territory to make his home in a strange land. And later, following God's command, Abraham again acted. He willingly offered up his son. So in each of these examples, these men acted out their faith. Their faith wasn't something that they simply believed intellectually. They stepped forward and acted in response to their faith in God and his promises. And when they did that, when they stepped forward and acted in faith, God worked extraordinary miracles in the lives of ordinary people, people who are actually fundamentally just like you and I. I mean, when we read about people like Abraham and Moses and David, sometimes it's easy to think of them as heroes, right? They're sort of like the biblical all-stars, and we're maybe like the third stringers or maybe not even good enough to make the team. But if you look closer at each one of their lives, it becomes pretty clear that none of them were entirely admirable people. For example, Abraham lied about Sarah being his wife. Moses murdered a man. And we know from studying David's life that he was a fallible person. He wasn't a great parent. He committed adultery, and he had a man murdered. All the men and women mentioned in chapter 11 were imperfect, fallen people. Like I said, they're just like you and I. But they were also people who were willing to step out and act in faith because they believed God's promises, and they knew those promises to be more worthy of seeking after than anything else in their lives. A great present-day example for me of someone who's done this, and I know a lot of you know Moffett. Moffett and Doreen have done incredible things. They've started the first Christ-centered university in Zambia, now has a farm, a medical clinic. They're impacting hundreds of lives because they were willing to act, to follow what they believed God wanted them to do. Now, another thing we can learn from the stories of the people named in chapter 11 is it's pretty clear that faith works in a variety of situations. In the lives of some of these men, their faith resulted in conquering in war, being delivered from animals or fire, even resurrection. In other lives, it involved building a boat, moving a family, the ability to have a child at age 100, choosing mistreatment above pleasure, or suffering persecution. Now, it's also clear from looking at the lives of the people with great faith who are listed in this chapter that a life of faith can involve a variety of outcomes as well. Faith sometimes had an immediate positive outcome, as when the people of Israel walked through the Red Sea or when the walls of Jericho fell. But in other lives, faith was rewarded with a delayed outcome or even a negative one. Abraham still had to wait 25 years for the son he was promised, and as I already mentioned, he never actually possessed the promised land. That promise from God was only realized generations later by his descendants. So those would both be good examples of when faith was rewarded with a delayed outcome. In other cases, having faith and acting on it didn't result in a good outcome here on this earth. Abel is one very good example of this. He was still murdered by his brother. And in 11:37, we read that some of these people of great faith were stoned to death, sawed in two, or put to death by the sword. Others were destitute, persecuted, or mistreated. So clearly, faithful people sometimes do not see what we would call good outcomes in their own lifetimes. But their faith is always rewarded by God. And these men of faith were willing to endure torture or even death because they looked beyond their immediate life to their ultimate destination, knowing that they would be rewarded in heaven by seeking God while they were here on earth. In verse 26, we're told about Moses that he regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than all the treasures in Egypt because he was looking ahead to his reward. One primary reward that's mentioned several times in this chapter is God's commendation. Abel was commended as a righteous man. Enoch was commended as one who pleased God. Each one of the people listed in chapter 11 at some point got to hear God say, "Well done." Now we know that the writer of Hebrews was calling on first century Jewish Christians who were suffering persecution and who were faltering in their faith to instead to hang on to their faith and to live boldly by that faith. Sorry, I'm having trouble turning my pages. And the writer of Hebrews is calling us this morning to do the same thing. We're being called to hang on to our faith in Jesus and to live boldly by that faith, even if we're experiencing difficult circumstances. As one of the commentaries that I read put it, if you think you're inadequate to living a life of faith in tough circumstances, just remember that all those men and women listed in chapter 11, they were inadequate too. Rahab was a prostitute. Jacob was a deceiver. Gideon was a doubter. But despite their flaws, all of them acted in faith and they hung on to God's promises. And of course, God's greatest promise of eternal life with him is something we have to have faith in because it's not something we're going to experience in this lifetime. So just like all the people in the Old Testament talked about in this chapter of Hebrews, we're called to live lives of faith in an unseen but living God. I don't know if you guys remember, but we had some really cold spells this last winter. And during one of them, which actually turned out to be the coldest few days, I had an appointment to have my furnace tuned up, which seemed like a good idea at the time. So the technician got to my house, and I took him out back to where the furnace was, and he started working on it. And over the next hour, he called me out there about 5 times to show me something that wasn't working right or something that was about to not work right. And our furnace was pretty old, so at the about the 5th time he'd called me out there, it became apparent that instead of trying to tune up or fix this old furnace, we probably needed to get a new one. Then he decided to take a look at the ductwork under my house. So he crawled around down there for about 20 minutes, and then he came out to tell me that, and the ductwork was about almost 30 years old, that it was literally disintegrating and that half of the ducts weren't even hooked up to the vents anymore. So apparently I'd been heating half of Corona Del Mar during this cold winter. Now, where's Christina? Okay, if we ever play one of your icebreaker games again, where you tell someone something about yourself they might not necessarily know, what I could tell people is that I am cold a lot of the time. My hands and feet are freezing. I'm just colder than everybody else. And I don't like being cold because I feel like I've spent half my life being cold. Now, as my friend Nancy Carpenter will tell you, everybody, including Superman, has their weakness. That's their kryptonite. Superman couldn't handle kryptonite. I don't handle cold very well. I don't like it. So when I was in the middle of this furnace duct repair job, and they told me that because the crawl space under my house was so narrow, it was really hard for the guys to maneuver and pull out the old ducts and put in the new ones, it would probably take 2 days, which meant there was going to be one night where we wouldn't have any heat in my house. And it was really cold. So this was not a happy situation for me. Now, at this point, some of you might be thinking, interesting story. Others of you are probably thinking, boring story. But all of you are probably wondering why I'm telling you this story and what it has to do with the central lesson of chapter 11 of Hebrews, which is living a life of faith in an unseen God. Well, one of the commentaries that I read to prepare to teach this lesson made what I thought was a fantastic analogy between God and the furnace that provides central heating in a house. Now, I'm willing to admit that it's possible that this analogy spoke so strongly to me because cold is my kryptonite, and so I love things like furnaces, and I had just had my furnace replaced. I'll tell you the analogy, and you guys can decide for yourselves whether you like it as much as I did. So the man who wrote this commentary lives somewhere back east where it gets really cold in the winter. And in this particular anecdote, he said that he took great comfort when he would wake up in the middle of one of those cold winter nights and he would hear that, you know, whoosh sound of his furnace turning on. And the point that he made was that his furnace was unseen, but that it made its presence felt in his life and in the life of his family by surrounding them with its radiance. And he actually used the word radiance. Now, I don't know if you guys remember, but way back when we were studying the first 4 verses of the book of Hebrews, there's a phrase in there that says, the sun is the radiance of God's glory. Now, the word's being used in different ways, but I thought that was pretty cool that he used the word radiance. But to make his analogy, he went on to say that this furnace that he couldn't always see was always present in the background of his life. And as I thought about what he was saying, I thought, yeah, when he's in that house, that furnace literally impacts every breath that man takes. And for people who live lives of faith in God, it's just the same. Even though we can't see him, God's presence is always there in the background of our lives. And instead of heat or radiance, we know God is there because of the grace and the mercy and the love that flow from him and that surround us, that permeate our lives, and that literally impact every breath that we take. And that's the God who's calling us to live lives of faith in him, just like Abraham and Moses and the other people in chapter 11 of the book of Hebrews did. So I'd like to close with a couple questions that I hope will be good for discussion in our small groups. So the first one is, even though we can't see God, we know he exists. We know he cares about how we live our lives. We know he wants us to live lives of faith in him, just like the people in chapter 11. So now pretend for just a moment that you didn't have faith in God. And then ask yourself, what would my life look like? How would I be living then that's different than how I'm living now? So another way to look at that question is how I live my life as a Christian with faith in God different than how my unbelieving neighbor lives his life or her life? My second question has to do with the first part of this restatement of the verse on faith. What would that phrase, faith is confidence that results in action, really look like in our lives? Can you think of one or two specific ways that you could act out your faith? It could be with family members, neighbors, coworkers, but some specific things that you could do, some action you could take that would be a manifestation of your faith. And I have one more question, and before I put it out there, I just feel like I need to say, when some of you hear this question, you might find yourself thinking, easier said than done, or you might find yourself thinking, she has never walked in my shoes. She has no way of knowing the issues that I've had to face, the situations that I've had to deal with. And I just want to acknowledge that's true. That's right. And I thought maybe I wasn't the right person to pose this question because I don't have the kind of personal experience with some really hard issues that I know some women in this room have had experience with. But then I, thinking about it, I thought, no, the question needs to be asked because I think it's one of the lessons that we're meant to learn, to take away from this chapter of Hebrews. And I'm just the person who was called to teach on this lesson this morning. So the third question, which I'll throw out there is, if you're dealing with a really difficult situation right now, and it could be relational with people in your family, or it could be your financial situation, it could be a health issue that you're dealing with or someone close to you in your family's dealing with, but it's a situation where the outcome, it doesn't really look very good. So the question is, what does living a life of faith look like in any of those scenarios? So those are the questions. If you didn't have a chance to write them down because I didn't put them up in the PowerPoint, I have them typed up here so you can come up and take a look at them for me. But will you bow with me now and close in prayer? Heavenly Father, thank you for being a God that we can trust in. Thank you for loving us so much that you sent your son to die for us so that we could have our sins forgiven and so that we could be in relationship with you. And help us to hang on to our faith. Help us to be like the people in chapter 11 of Hebrews. Regardless of what our situation is, help us to hang on to our faith in Jesus and what he did for us. And help us to act boldly in our faith so that one day we can be commended by you as well and hear you say, well done. And I ask all these things in your son's name.